In his new book, Kissinger: Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman, acclaimed historian Greg Grandin argues that to understand our never-ending wars abroad and political polarization at home, we have to understand Henry Kissinger. Examining Kissinger's own writings as well as a wealth of newly declassified documents, Grandin reveals how Richard Nixon's top foreign policy advisor, even as he was presiding over defeat in Vietnam and a disastrous secret and illegal war in Cambodia, was helping to revive a militarized version of American exceptionalism centered on an imperial presidency. Going beyond accounts focusing either on Kissinger's crimes or accomplishments, Grandin offers a new interpretation of the diplomat's continuing influence on how the United States views its role in the world. Greg Grandin is the author. He is also a professor of history at New York University, and it's a pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
What brought you to this subject and wanting to look at Kissinger and the power that he has had over the last several decades?
Well, I'm an historian of the U.S. and the world, and U.S. and Latin America, and Kissinger has played an outsized role in that history. Events in Chile and Argentina and elsewhere in the 1970s, but also Kissinger's 92 years old, and there's a certain rehabilitation of his legacy underway. And you see Hillary Clinton embracing him. You see Barack Obama and John Kerry seeking his counsel. You see journalists writing essays, calling on a return to some kind of Kissingerian grand vision of diplomacy. And I wanted to write a corrective. Most critiques of Kissinger focus on his crimes, and there's no list of transgressions that people accuse him of that led to hundreds of thousands of deaths and misery on a grand scale, but I think that that also misses the point. I think that misses his role in rehabilitating the national security state in the wake of Vietnam and kind of putting it on new footings, able to kind of move out in the world and directly leading to where we are now: endless war, endless surveillance, and a kind of permanent state of emergency.
Give us a sense of how we, because I find it interesting of how we've reached that point of how the narrative has changed over the period of time, given what has happened in our history, and as you point out in the book, a fairly clear line of policy that led us to this.
You mean how the narrative about Kissinger has changed?
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because in the early 2000s, he was roundly he was still very influential and powerful. He presided over Kissinger Associates. He had contacts in the media, in the business world, China, and all of that. But at least in the public, he was associated with Pol Pot, Augusto Pinochet, all of these unsavory dictators from the Cold War. Christopher Hitchens wrote his best-selling book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, and his reputation really tanked. I think things started to change a little bit earlier than that. Bill Clinton embraced him, first Democrat embraced him. Kissinger helped Clinton negotiate and pass NAFTA, a little side note of Kissinger's career that nobody really knows that much about. And then after 9/11, and after the disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and after what some people would describe as a kind of visionlessness of Barack Obama, a kind of technocratic pragmatism that has no sense of purpose, doesn't understand the American's purpose in the world, people are beginning to hold up Kissinger as an alternative to those two things, an alternative to the neoconservative recklessness of George Bush and the technocratic pragmatism of Barack Obama. Kissinger is held up as a visionary and a statesman, harkening back to an older way of doing diplomacy. And the point of my book is to argue that Kissinger actually makes possible the neoconservatives. He's not opposed to them. He lays the ideological groundwork for them, and then he makes their peace with them. Kissinger was in favor not just of the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, but also further. He wanted to go into Sudan. He wanted to go into Yemen. He was urging the Bush administration to stay strong into 2005, 2006, 2007. So the opposition of Kissinger to the neoconservatives, I think, is a delusion, an illusion.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you delve deep into Kissinger's own writings as well as declassified documents, newly declassified documents. What did you get from those and that helped in your understanding of Kissinger and his beliefs?
Well, again, I wasn't so much trying to establish culpability or guilt, you know, and left that to, you know, Christopher Hitchens and others. What I was trying to get at was his political philosophy and how it isn't alien to American exceptionalism or to American sense of itself in the world as it's often portrayed. You know, when Kissinger's 92, when he dies, he'll be, you know, there'll be much discussion about how his real politique or his realism, was at kind of askew to American exceptionalism. And I don't think that that's true at all. I think if you actually look at his philosophy of history, and I went back and I read his 500-page undergraduate thesis, The Meaning of History at Harvard, that he wrote in 1950, and that was on Kant and Spengler and these German philosophers and metaphysicians. What you get there is that Kissinger was not a realist. He was an idealist. I don't mean an idealist in the sense that he wanted to defend human rights, but he make a strong argument that reality doesn't exist, or if it exists, human beings don't have access to it. We can only understand reality through acting in the world. And this has kind of been his constant advice from the beginning to the present, that presidents have to act. It doesn't matter whether they get it right or whether they get it wrong. He says that's secondary. What matters is that they are willing to act, and they act in the world, and in so doing, that gives us an awareness of our power, our interests, and our ideals. Now, that's the exact opposite of how Kissinger is often portrayed, and it's very, very close to the kind of heady kind of romanticism of the neocons that drove us into Iraq, thinking that we could remake reality, remake the world just by sheer force of will.
You talk in the book about that his insistence that intuition is more important in determining policy than hard facts. I mean, there's something to be said for intuition, but there's also obviously something to be said about facts. Why did he not have more challenges and obstacles with that viewpoint?
Well, he did. I mean, most of his foreign policies were disasters, right? I mean, he bombed Cambodia for 3.5
years. Yes, before they became disasters, of someone saying, okay, well, this is what we should actually be doing.
Well, you know, he came up at a moment when, you know, the liberals were in power, the New Deal liberals, the Kennedy kind of, you know, Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, and systems analysis. They believed that you could reduce the world to a series of economic formulas. You could drive out any kind of intuition, any kind of conjecture, any kind of intangible like that. Kissinger is very much a type that we see coming up in the U.S. foreign policy establishment every other generation that criticizes what they see as an over-bureaucratization of the foreign policy establishment that relies too much on information. So Kissinger did that exactly to, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson and Robert McNamara and you know, arguing for intuition and conjecture, and statesmen just have to act. You can't be, you know, you can't charge a committee of 12 people to assemble what becomes the Pentagon Papers and then become paralyzed by it. And what's ironic is that then the neocons, when they come up in the 70s, they use that critique against Kissinger. When Kissinger's established, particularly Kissinger, and you know, when he's in the Ford administration in 75 and 76, so there is a kind of recurrent cycle within American foreign policy establishment, when militarists want to push the debate to the right, they invoke conjecture, they invoke the importance of intuition, they invoke the importance of will. And we saw this with, I mean, why this is important is because that's exactly what led us into Iraq. When Dick Cheney said that, you know, if we have a hunch that the Iraqis are building weapons of mass destruction, or if we have a 1% belief that Saddam Hussein was in league with al-Qaeda, we have to act as if it's 100% certainty. It's the same exact kind of, it's a form of German German romanticism, a kind of, you know, will to power, will to infinity, that I think is deeply embedded in U.S. militarism.
You end your book, the epilogue, is entitled Kissingerism Without Kissinger. How long do you think that will last? How long do you think that shadow will be present? And do you see that being changed or being further embraced?
Well, I see it being embraced. I mean, I see Hillary Clinton writing essays in the Washington Post praising Henry Kissinger, calling him a friend, saying that she seeks his counsel. I see Samantha Power, who wrote books on genocide, including genocides that Henry Kissinger was implicated in Cambodia and East Timor and Bangladesh. And I see them two going to Boston Red Sox games and bantering as if they were geopolitical Tracy and Hepburns. I see journalists penning essays every time there's a sense that U.S. foreign policy has gone adrift, penning essays saying we need to restore a kind of Kissinger vision. But it's unclear at this moment what the content of that vision is, and I think that that's because it never did have a content. It always was circular. We had to project our power in order to have an understanding of our purpose, and we had to act according to our purpose in order to know our power. I think there's a kind of circular logic to that way of thinking that is embedded in Kissinger's philosophy of history and philosophy of diplomacy and philosophy of war in particular, that has led us to this disaster in which serial interventions just deepen the problem. And also, let me just say that there's a way in which Kissinger is also good at covering up the blowback, right? Because it's not about looking at the past as a series of cause and events. It's about looking at the past as an analogy. So when Dick Cheney looks at and says, look, we could debate what happened 12 or 13 years ago and who's responsible for the creation of ISIS, but we have a problem, and our responsibility as statesmen is to the future, not to the past, and we have to act. That's pure Kissingerism. You know, just the way of let historians and journalists debate and document the blowback. You know, we can't be paralyzed by it. So past actions give rise to Saddam Hussein, the invasion of Iraq gives rise to ISIS. Who knows what the fight against ISIS is going to give rise to? But and so it goes. There's a kind of circularity that I think U.S. power in the world is caught up in and trapped by. And I think Kissinger is not solely responsible, but I think Kissinger and the way that he is fetishized and elevated is a good window into understanding it.
Greg Grandin is the author of the new book, Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. The book is published by Metropolitan. Greg Grandin, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Kissinger's Shadow, by Greg Grandin. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.